A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
My back hurts in places I didn't know I had places. Day 3 of moving a 60 square meter apartment a few hundred meters down the street, and I'm sitting here asking myself the same question over and over. Is moving just supposed to feel this physically devastating, or are we doing something fundamentally wrong?
You did more prep than anyone I know. You decluttered, you gave stuff away, you sold things, you pre-packed into Euro boxes, you hauled half of it yourself before the movers even showed up. And you're still on day 3.
That's the part that's missing with my head. The gap between how much we prepared and how brutal the actual experience has been. It's never felt wider. I genuinely thought this time would be different.
Yeah, it wasn't.
It was worse. The movers are exhausted. I'm exhausted. Hannah's exhausted. And there's still a pile of leftovers I'm going to have to finish myself. We moved a few hundred meters. A few hundred meters.
Daniel sent us this one from the middle of exactly that. He's in the thick of it, fresh off the third day of a move that was supposed to be handled by professionals. And he's asking whether he and Hannah are missing some obvious formula that would make this less soul-crushing. Or whether the physics of moving an apartment through a tiny elevator in the Jerusalem summer is just inherently brutal no matter what you do.
There's a bigger question underneath it. They've been through this every couple of years because of Israel's tenancy at will system. Leases ending against their will. Forced moves on landlord timelines. No ability to wait for a cooler month or a better prepared window. Now they've got a kid, which means more stuff and less energy. And they keep circling back to the same thought. We will do anything to own our next property, and never do this again.
Which is a thought a lot of people have had while staring at a wall of boxes in a 100-degree stairwell. The question is whether buying actually solves it, or whether the real problem is something else entirely.
Let's dig into this. What is it about moving in Israel specifically that makes it feel uniquely awful, even when you do everything right?
Here's the thing that jumped out at me from what Daniel described. He did everything right by any rational standard, and the move still took 3 days. That's not a failure of effort. That's a signal that the system itself is structured for a kind of moving that doesn't match how people actually live.
It's not like this is a one-off trauma you recover from and move on. The tenancy at will system here means the average renter in Israel moves every 2 to 3 years. Sometimes less if a landlord decides to sell or move a relative in.
Which they can do with 60 to 90 days notice for what's called personal use. So you're not choosing when to move. The landlord is choosing for you. August in Jerusalem, no AC in the stairwell, 30 plus degrees, direct sun on the moving truck. You don't get to wait for October.
That's the structural piece that makes this different from moving in a lot of other places. It's not just that moving is hard. It's that the system guarantees you'll do it repeatedly, on someone else's schedule, in conditions you'd never choose.
The central puzzle Daniel's really laying out here is the problem personal, logistical, or structural? Is it that they have too much stuff, that they're using the wrong strategy, or that the rental market itself makes this inevitable?
I think the honest answer is probably all three, but not in equal measure. The question is, which one is actually doing the most damage?
Let's start with the physics, because that's where the numbers get surprising. Daniel described the 60 square meter apartment with what sounds like a pretty minimal setup. Kitchen, home office with one Ivar unit, nursery with a few toys, bedroom. No storage unit, no garage full of stuff. And yet the movers are on day 3.
Which sounds absurd until you actually count what's in those rooms.
A standard Eurobox is 60 by 40 by 37 centimeters. A modest kitchen. Pots, pans, dishes, utensils, pantry items. That's 15 to 20 boxes right there. A home office with books and equipment, another 10 to 15. Nursery toys and baby gear, 10 boxes minimum. Bedroom, clothes, linens, personal items, another 15 to 20. Add bathroom, cleaning supplies, random decor, and you're looking at 80 to 120 boxes before you even touch furniture.
Furniture is the real multiplier. A bed frame, a mattress, a couch, a dining table, chairs, the Ivar shelving unit, a crib, a washing machine, a refrigerator. Every single one of those is a separate trip.
Now here's where the elevator becomes the bottleneck. A standard Israeli apartment elevator is about 1.2 meters by 1.4 meters, with a 400 kilogram capacity. You can theoretically fit 12 Euroboxes in there, but in practice, with door clearance and stacking limits, movers can only manage 4 to 6 boxes per trip. So for 100 boxes, you're looking at 17 to 25 elevator cycles just for the boxes alone.
We haven't even started on the furniture that might not fit in the elevator at all.
A couch or a mattress often has to go down the stairs. In a Jerusalem building that's 4 or 5 stories, that's a mover carrying a mattress down a narrow stairwell in 30-degree heat with no air conditioning. Do that 6 or 7 times for the large items, and you've burned an hour and a half of peak energy before noon.
Daniel mentioned this was August. The heat isn't just discomfort. It's a genuine safety and efficiency multiplier. You're losing breaks to water and rest. You're losing grip strength. You're losing decision-making quality. What would take 4 hours in October take 7 in August?
There's actual research on this. Physical labor in temperatures above 30 Celsius reduces work capacity by roughly 30 to 40% compared to temperate conditions. So the movers are slower, they need more breaks, and they're making more mistakes. That's not a failure of the moving company, that's just human physiology.
You've got this triple stack already. The sheer volume of a minimal household, the elevator acting as a throttle on throughput, and the heat draining everyone's capacity. But the thing that really turns this from a hard day into a 3-day ordeal is the timeline.
This is where the comparison with other countries gets stark. In Germany or Switzerland, it's standard for tenants to have 2 to 4 weeks of overlapping leases. You get the keys to the new place while you still have the old one. So you can move incrementally. A few boxes after work each day, the heavy furniture on one Saturday with friends, the kitchen over a weekend. It's still work, but it's distributed work.
Whereas in Israel, Daniel said it himself. Renters typically call the moving company 3 to 5 days before the move date. Everything has to happen in one compressed window because the lease ends on a specific day and the new one starts the next morning. There's no overlap.
The tenancy at will system makes this worse in a specific way. A landlord can terminate your lease with 60 to 90 days notice for personal use. They're moving back in, or a family member is. So you're not just moving on a compressed timeline. You're moving on a timeline you didn't choose. You can't wait for cooler weather. You can't wait until you've saved up for better movers. The date is the date.
That's the part that keeps catching us. It's not that we're disorganized or that we own too much. It's that the system eliminates every variable that would make this easier. No choice of season, no choice of timeline, no overlap between properties, and a physical bottleneck in the form of a tiny elevator that no amount of preparation can widen.
When you compare that to a typical U.S. move, the difference isn't just cultural preference, it's structural. In most U.S. leases, you get at least 2 weeks of overlap if you plan for it, sometimes a full month. You can rent a truck for a week and do it in stages. You're probably moving between places with garages or ground floor access. The elevator bottleneck doesn't exist in the same way.
Daniel's move was a few hundred meters. In a system with overlapping leases, that's a non-event. You walk boxes over every evening for a week. You roll the heavy stuff on a dolly one Saturday, and you're done. Instead, 3 days of professional movers, and there's still a pile left.
When Daniel asks whether he's missing some easy formula, the answer is that the formula he's missing isn't available to him. The physics are brutal because the temporal structure of Israeli renting forces all the brutality into a single compressed window, and the elevator ensures that window can't be shortened no matter how much you pay the movers or how much you declutter.
Which brings us to the psychology of why doing more prep didn't help. But that's a different layer of the problem.
The psychology piece is where this gets cruel. Daniel mentioned the last move, 3 years ago, is etched in his memory. That's not poetic language. That's the amygdala doing exactly what it evolved to do. There's research on what's called moving fatigue, the finding that each subsequent move within a 5-year window has diminishing returns on your ability to cope. Your first move as an adult, you bounce back in a week. The second one, you're rattled for a month. By the third or fourth, your body starts bracing for it before the boxes even arrive.
which explains why Daniel did more prep than ever and it still felt worse. The preparation is rational. The dread is physiological.
They feed each other. You remember how bad the last one was, so you overprepare. And when the overpreparation doesn't prevent the suffering, it feels like a betrayal. Like you followed the instructions and the machine still broke.
That's the decluttering paradox he's living right now. He decluttered, gave things away, sold stuff, pre-packed into Euroboxes, and the move was still 3 days of misery.
Here's why. Let's say Daniel reduced his total volume by 20%, which is impressive for a pre-move declutter. Most people manage 10 to 15, so he went from 100 boxes to 80. That saves maybe 3 or 4 elevator trips. Out of 20-plus cycles, you don't feel 3 fewer trips when you're still doing 17.
The bottleneck was never the total volume. It was the elevator cycle count.
Decluttering solves a volume problem, but Daniel doesn't have a volume problem. He has a throughput problem. The elevator can only move 4 to 6 boxes at a time, no matter how many boxes there are. Cutting the pile from 100 to 80 just means the movers finish at 4 in the afternoon instead of 4:30. It doesn't change the fundamental experience of the day.
Which is why he keeps circling back to that thought. We will do anything to own our next property. It feels like the only escape hatch.
That's where the ownership fantasy gets interesting. Israeli home ownership is about 65%. That's higher than Germany at 43%, much lower than Romania at 88%. But here's the thing. Buying doesn't eliminate moves. It just changes their frequency.
You still move. You just move less often.
Often for the same reasons. Job change, need more space, need less space, divorce, schools. The real variable isn't ownership versus renting, it's tenure stability. A renter in Germany with a 5-year lease and overlapping move windows might actually move less often than a homeowner in Tel Aviv who trades up every few years.
The thought Daniel's having, if we just buy, this stops, is understandable, but it's aiming at the wrong target. The pain isn't coming from the rent check. It's coming from the fact that every move is a compressed, non-negotiable sprint in August or a tiny elevator.
Which brings us to what would actually help, the incremental move model. In parts of Europe, tenants routinely have 2 to 4 weeks of overlapping possession. You hold both sets of keys, you move gradually.
Let's run the numbers on that. In Jerusalem, 2 extra weeks of rent on a 60 square meter apartment is roughly 5,000 to 6,000 shekels. 3 days of professional movers is about 3,000 to 4,000 shekels. So the incremental model costs about 5,500 in extra rent versus 3,500 for the sprint.
You're not paying movers for 3 days in the incremental model. You're renting a van for a day to move the heavy furniture and doing the rest yourself over evenings. So the real comparison is 5,500 shekels for a low-stress distributed move versus 3,500 for a 3-day physical catastrophe plus whatever you spend on ibuprofen and lost work days.
When you frame it that way, the incremental model is actually cheaper in total cost, not just in suffering, but it's completely unavailable under Israeli lease structures.
Because the leases don't overlap. Your old lease ends on the 30th, your new one starts on the 1st. There's no mechanism for holding both.
Which creates this bizarre market gap. Why isn't there a slow move service in Israel? A company that drops off empty Euroboxes 2 weeks before your move date, picks them up in batches over the course of a week, and delivers them to the new place gradually?
The German model is instructive here. They have something called the Umzugskarten system. Moving companies deliver 50 standardized boxes 3 weeks before the move, with color-coded labels and scheduled pickup windows. You pack at your own pace. They collect on a schedule. The move becomes a process instead of an event.
The economics work. If a slow move service in Jerusalem charged 4,000 shekels for gradual pickup and delivery over 10 days, they'd undercut the combined cost of the sprint model while offering a fundamentally better experience. Daniel would pay a premium for that. I would pay a premium for that.
The market gap is real. There are 2 or 3 startups in Tel Aviv experimenting with full service packing and unpacking on gradual timelines, but nothing equivalent in Jerusalem. And the reason they can exist in Tel Aviv is that some landlords there are starting to offer flexible move-in windows as a competitive amenity.
We're back to the structural problem. The service innovation can't happen at scale until the lease structures allow for it. The lease structures won't change until rent is demanded. And renters can't demand it because they're too exhausted from moving to organize.
That's the trap. The system produces exhausted people, and exhausted people don't have the bandwidth to change the system.
Okay, so if the system is broken and the psychology is against us, what can we actually do? Let's get practical.
First one is the highest leverage move, and it's the one Daniel didn't think to try. Negotiate for overlapping lease periods.
Even a week.
Even 5 to 7 days of dual possession transforms the experience from a 3-day sprint into a manageable process. You offer the landlord an extra 1,000 to 2,000 shekels for that week of overlap. Most landlords haven't considered it because nobody asks. But if they've already terminated your lease for personal use, they're not moving in the next morning. They're painting, renovating, whatever. A week of flexibility costs them almost nothing.
It saves you the 3-day catastrophe. That's 1,000 shekels for what? A 70% reduction in misery. Best return on investment available.
Measure your elevator, not your stuff. The bottleneck is cycles, not volume. So pre-pack in containers that maximize elevator utilization. Tall, narrow boxes that stack 3 high instead of wide Euro boxes that only stack 2 high. You can fit 50% more per trip with the right container geometry.
Which means fewer trips. Which means less time in the heat. Which means the move is finished before they're destroyed.
If you can't get overlap, break the move into phases. Move non-essentials, off-season clothes, books, decor, 1 to 2 weeks early using your own car or a small van rental. Reserve the movers for a single day of heavy furniture and essentials only. You're not reducing the total work, but you're taking the peak load off the day that matters most.
Fourth, this is the one I think Daniel should actually pursue. There are 2 or 3 startups in Tel Aviv offering full-service backing and unbacking with gradual timelines. Moving concierge services. They don't exist in Jerusalem yet, but that's not a reason to give up. That's a market gap, and Daniel has the leverage to demand it.
If enough renters ask moving companies for a slow move option, someone will build it. The economics work. We just ran the numbers. A company that charges 4,000 shekels for gradual pickup and delivery over 10 days would be cheaper for the customer than the sprint model when you factor in lost workdays and physical recovery.
They'd have a captive market of exhausted people who will pay anything to never do this again.
Those are the hacks. But the question that's been nagging at me through this whole conversation is whether we should need hacks at all.
That's the thing. I keep hearing this argument, usually from people who don't rent, that moving every 2 to 3 years is actually a feature of the Israeli system. It keeps you mobile for job opportunities, prevents you from accumulating too much stuff, stops you from getting too comfortable.
The forced minimalism argument.
Like the tenancy at will system is doing you a favor by periodically shaking you loose. And I can see the logic on paper. If you know you're moving every couple of years, you don't buy the pool table, you don't accumulate the basement full of stuff you never use.
Here's the problem with that argument. The cost of forced mobility isn't just the physical exhaustion of moving day. It's the lost work days, the mover fees every 2 years, the furniture that breaks in transit, the deposits you lose because you couldn't patch every hole in the wall. It's the psychological toll of never fully settling anywhere.
With a kid, it's the disruption of routines, the loss of familiar spaces, the inability to plant anything, literally or metaphorically, because you know a landlord termination notice could arrive any year.
The mobility benefit is real if you're 22 and might take a job in Haifa next month. It's a lot less real if you're 35 with a child and you're moving within the same neighborhood because your landlord's son needs the apartment.
No, I don't buy the feature. Not a bug argument. Not at the cost Daniel's describing. The system isn't optimizing for mobility. It's optimizing for landlord flexibility, and renters are paying the difference in back pain and lost weekends.
Which raises the forward-looking question. Remote work has changed the geography of employment in Israel the same way it has everywhere else. If you don't need to live near a tech campus in Herzliya or an office in central Tel Aviv, you can look at peripheral areas, the Galilee, the Negev, smaller towns where housing pressure is lower.
In theory, lower housing pressure means landlords have less leverage. Longer leases, more flexibility on move-in dates, maybe even negotiated overlap periods. The tenancy at-will system only works as a landlord's market when demand outstrips supply.
The question is whether remote work actually shifts enough demand to change that dynamic. Central Israel has a housing shortage that's been building for decades. A few thousand remote workers decamping to the periphery doesn't fix the structural undersupply in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv.
The tenancy at will system stays entrenched where most people actually live, and Daniel's experience, the August move, the tiny elevator, the 3-day ordeal, keeps repeating for the next renter and the one after that.
Which brings us to the uncomfortable final thought. Daniel's going to finish this move. He's going to unpack the last box, collapse the last Eurobox, and sit down in his new living room and swear never again. And then, in 2 or 3 years, another landlord termination notice is going to arrive, and the cycle starts over.
The question isn't really whether he'll move again. The question is whether the system changes before he does, whether overlapping leases become negotiable, whether slow move services reach Jerusalem, whether the market innovates faster than the exhaustion sets in.
Right now, sitting in the middle of day 3 with a pile of leftovers still waiting, that's not a question anyone has the energy to answer.
Right now, the only question is where the screwdriver went, and whether the bed frame is ever going back together.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Hanseatic League had strict rules governing the trade of woad, the blue dye plant. In 14th century Lübeck, merchants caught adulterating woad with cheaper pigments faced confiscation of their entire shipment and a lifetime ban from all Hanseatic ports, a punishment severe enough that woad quality became a point of civic pride across the Baltic trade network.
I don't know what to do with woad fraud in my current state of mind, but I respect the enforcement mechanism.
A lifetime ban over blue dye. Hilbert, you find the strangest corners of history.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It helps other exhausted movers find the show. You can also reach us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back next week with something that hopefully requires zero heavy lifting. Until then, I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Somebody find me an ice pack.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.